Vi ste uz SBS na srpskom. Pronađite još interesantnih priloga na sbs.com.au/srbijan.
I'm very grateful that Carlo has dedicated some time to speak with us today. My name is Nina Marković, and I am your host today. Carlo, it's amazing to have you with us today. We've actually met earlier this year at an interesting function promoting the themes of multiculturalism and health advocacy. And you work for so many different areas of this field, for the government, for the consumer section, advocacy section, for multiculturalism in health space. Can you please tell us more about your work? Because I don't believe that most of our listeners have ever encountered your profession.
Sure. Thanks, Nina. So my name is Carlo Kokoa. I'm the Director of Policy and Programs at the Multicultural Health Collaborative, which is an initiative of FECA, which is the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia. So a lot of people probably wouldn't have heard of either of those organisations, or maybe not even know what a peak body or an advocacy body actually is or does. So I focus on the health sector, and essentially considering that around 30% of the Australian population comes from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. That is not actually represented in government services and health funding. So our job at the collaborative is to ensure that those government services and resources are directed towards multicultural populations.
From my time of working for the federal parliament, I think we had a lot of workshops and a lot of sort of initiatives how to make the space more accommodating for people from diverse backgrounds. From your vast experience over the last, I would say, 15 years, what shifts have you witnessed in this space, especially at the sort of federal government or state government level? Have we actually progressed as a country in this space, or are there still many gaps to fill?
There are still many gaps, and it's a product of, I guess, the health system. Anyway, there's this saying in the health advocacy lobbying space that, you know, to get any reform done in the healthcare system usually takes about 10 years. It's like, you know, steering a cruise liner. It's not a speedboat. And so in terms of what shifts have I seen, multiculturalism has always been this term that has been bandied around by, you know, politicians from both sides of the aisle. But in terms of what it actually means as a funding investment, I'm not sure that we've actually seen a shift. If anything, it's probably, with the last federal budget, seen a shift the other way in reduction of services directly targeting multicultural populations.
Why do you think is that?
I'm not sure. It's politically driven. I'm not probably equipped to answer that in a political sense, I guess. But there is some research that's probably due to be published relatively soon coming out of one of our university partners. And they did a analysis of the funding for the NHMRC, so Medical Health and Research Council, and MRFF, so Medical Research Future Fund. So basically those are the two funding bodies the government uses to commission research into health. And out of the billions of dollars that they've given those organisations, only, I'll ask you, so what percentage of those, say, $5 billion, I think it's like $5 to $7 billion over the previous 5 years, what percentage do you think has gone to research focusing on the health of cold communities?
Of multicultural communities? Mm-hmm. I would say less than 1%.
You're absolutely right. It's less than 1%. When you think that we make up about 30% of the population, that is almost, it's an abomination, really. Like, how can you possibly get the data that you need to serve 30% of the population if the research that you're funding is not actually focused or inclusive of them?
Perhaps one problem is the lack of understanding that the multicultural communities might have further, I would say, needs. I loved at the summit, which we both attended, organized by the Ethnolink organization. One of the presentations there was saying how, for example, the word cancer has a very different connotation in Arabic. Actually, it's a very negative word. And for any cancer awareness campaigns, those designing them have to be very culturally aware and not even use the word cancer if they want to get the honest answers and data, because people believe if they use that word, they will get it themselves.
Yeah.
In your work with multicultural communities, did you find that there is that barrier of understanding how to translate your own cultural identity and needs to a higher level to be able to present and lobby for funding? Because if you don't have data in the first place, how do you do it as a community organization?
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, right? So we use the terms multicultural populations or cult, but it's not a homogenous group, right? There are like something like over 200 language groups within that group. So you can't treat cult population as one group that only needs to hear one type of message. So that's at the collaborative, we have two cancer screening programs at the moment. So we have early lung cancer screening, and then we also have cervical screening. And what we do, our approach to engaging with communities is the government hands us the key messages and the program outline parameters, and we ensure that that information is directed and translated to those communities in such a way as to not, you know, culturally offend them, to be culturally relevant, and importantly, to be significant so that they take action. And what often happens is, you know, and I was guilty of this myself. I started off my career in federal government at the Attorney General's Department. And so often we sit in Canberra behind our desks and write policy for people on the ground who we never see. Right. So what we do at the collaborative is we get the funding from the government to disseminate these messages, but we actually give most of it to community organizations so that they can do it themselves. So one of the issues in the multicultural sector is that there is a lack of capacity in being able to communicate your message and have it reach, you know, the hill in Canberra. And for us, that is a critical part of what we do. So we're the we're the peak body for multicultural seniors, and we're also a health peak body as well. And so we want community organizations, wherever they're from, to be able to come to us, tell us what you're experiencing on the ground, so we can communicate that in the various mechanisms that we have.
One of the families I recently spoke to, and they're from the Chinese background, they complained that there was no aged care in Mandarin in Sydney, and they would have to translocate the elderly people from their family to Melbourne. Yeah. When it comes to aged care in your local language, and this could be something you're familiar with, what are the main obstacles, and is there hope? Because a lot of older people would like to have that linguistic familiarity and cultural one when they go to an aged care home.
Look, that is a major issue, and one of the, you know, the first waves of European migrants. Now they've been around quite a long time. They've gone through aging and the aged care system, and so they have their own residential aged care facilities in their own language.
Italian groups as well.
Exactly. And so what we're seeing now is in these kind of Asian communities. You know, like it wasn't that long ago when the White Australia policy was, you know, a thing. I think it was 1973.
It was officially
abolished, right? So after that, that's when we really started seeing these waves of migration. And only now are they actually starting to wage. So your question was like, what can she do about potentially getting some language-specific, in-language support in residential aged care? Probably not a lot at the moment, because there is staffing shortages in the aged care system as well. You know, it's difficult enough getting someone to work in there, let alone someone in who speaks your Mandarin
language, yeah.
or whatever it is, yeah.
I mean, I suggested to her to maybe lobby the local government and try and organize one aged care herself with 10 other families. I'm not sure if that's a sustainable argument.
No, I think it could be, and I think that's kind of what you have to do, right? So our aged care system is designed to give the agency to the individual. You know, it's a very rights-based approach and self-directed. So you're the one that has to be your own advocate to ask for this service or that service. So you are able to, I guess, try to get services from someone who is in your language. And there are some organisations around Australia and just pockets that kind of do this well. Some of our member organisations for FECA, so we call them ECCs and MCCs, so Ethnic Communities Councils and Multicultural Communities Councils. So there is one in each state and territory, and they are members of FECA, and they make up our board, essentially. Some of those organisations do have multicultural-focused residential aged care, but you know, how do you cater for 200 language groups? You know, and I was in a consultation in Perth a couple months ago now, maybe. And I was talking to a group of community leaders from the Pacifica region. And it was really interesting. I don't know if I can say this.
No, of course, say it's an interesting example.
You know, like when we had lunch earlier today, we were talking about like racism, right? And racism is often perceived to be, you know, coming from an Anglo to other coloured brown people, right?
But absolutely doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be. In this group, they were even saying something like, no, if we set up a Pacifica aged care, residential aged care facilities, I'm from this country. I don't want to hang out with you people from your country. And you're like, you know.
And this was a formal consultation.
This is a formal consultation, yeah, yeah. You know. And everyone was like, yeah, of course, totally. Like, it's like,
so they accept. You
know. I know we're not recording this, but I'm Filipino, so very obviously have brown skin. Yeah, it's intriguing. It's an interesting way to think about how we group those cold populations. It's almost been done just out of for ease, right? It's much easier to kind of manage a group when you can kind of put them all into one bucket. But to understand the nuance of each culture, you know, their needs, you really have to make sure that you engage with each of them specifically, which is in our space, time consuming, very expensive. But if you want to provide good services, if you want to advocate for the right things, you really have to make sure that each voice is represented at the table.
We live in an age of AI and a very rapid technological advancement and change. And do you think this is changing the way you will do your work in the next sort of 2 to 4 years? And will it replace the human agent, yourself, for example, going to these consultations, meetings with an AI agent? And how do you think this is going to evolve in the short or long term?
Okay, I don't know how long we have, but that's a very interesting question and conversation to have, because I'm not sure, and maybe self-servingly, this is maybe why I believe this, but I genuinely think that the soft skills, like the conversation that we're having right now, sitting across from someone, being able to understand, you know, their facial expressions and the intonation and the tone, and being able to actually listen and to approach that with empathy is something that I don't think AI will be able to do.
Not yet.
Can you imagine? But there's also something to be said about like humanity and being human, and you know, sitting across from somebody and being able to engage with them. Like, I'm not sure that I would ever get to a point where, if it was, you know, the most human-like AI thing, whatever it is, on the screen, I'd be comfortable sharing personal experiences or health-related information. I don't think that will ever go. In terms of the impact on the health system, I think it could actually really help make it more efficient and effective, you know.
So there's a positive to it, you know.
That's absolutely a positive to it, you know. And I do like robots, so I kind of want to see them walking around a little bit more.
In Albania, they have a minister for AI who is an AI.
Really?
Yeah, so when the parliamentary debate happened and the AI minister started speaking, the opposition leaders walked out.
Because
they couldn't accept an AI persona, pretty much, being an AI
exactly
on the screen, being part of the parliamentary debate. But it was part of Albania's sitting late last year.
That's so interesting.
I was asked about it as a political scientist, and that's how I got to know and do some research. But it was very interesting to see in governance. And the whole point about Delilah, her name is, of this persona, is to streamline government procurement policies.
Yes, yes. See?
So that was the point.
In areas like that, definitely, it's going to be useful. Grant assessing, grant writing, you know. But here is a problem with this. The capacity of each organization, you know, each community organization varies so widely, right? You have some that are national and are very capable because they've been doing it for so long. And there are some who are just kind of like these little startups, essentially. But using AI, both organizations can now produce grant applications that are of the same standard, right? So if you're then using AI to assess those applications, right, they have an equal shot at getting that funding, but who can actually deliver those services?
So what do you think the answer will be in terms of decision makers?
I have no idea.
Because you probably are right now getting AI-driven applications. I mean,
100%. We just did a community grant, and there's definitely... I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't be that cheeky, but I often want to call them up and go, can you actually do that dash on the computer for me right now?
Like, where's the long dash?
Like, how do you do that?
Or the semicolon and the long dash.
Why are there so many lists on here? You know?
And trust. I mean, how will communities build trust with alongside this AI life that we are experiencing?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You do have a lot of trust building in your job. I mean, that's part of the job.
You get to know stakeholders.
No, yeah.
I think it's the entire job. And I don't... Like, we consult these communities, and for the most part, it's our first engagement with these individuals, right? So you have to... I'm not sure an AI or some kind of platform can walk into a room, can look at that person in the eye and go, tell me about your health experience, tell me about these very private matters that you don't really talk about it with anyone. Tell me about your STIs or your sexual health or sexual behavior or blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure that...
Maybe vulgar communities. But cultural elements come into those answers as well.
Yeah. We did a consultation in Hobart on mental health.
Amazing, right. Which is a taboo topic for a lot of communities,
Absolutely. And there were so many people there who shared their own lived experience with mental health, and you just, I'm not sure people would feel comfortable, you know, telling that to a technology, right?
It reminds me of those COVID videos from the US when a robot would come instead of a doctor to tell the person that they're dying from COVID and then to show the screen to their loved ones. I mean, that felt so dehumanizing, even though in that situation, when everyone was so scared of this, you know, mystery COVID illness at that time.
Yeah.
But how dehumanizing it was. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And when it comes to your advice, so if you I guess a lot of communities listening to us maybe would not have had any contact with the whole idea of community funding for community services. Mm. Is there any piece of advice you would give to a startup in this space? Like, where do they start from? What should they look out? Should they get a consultant to help them? Or, I mean, you would see hundreds and hundreds of these new organizations every year, I would say.
Yeah, we do. And I think it would depend on the mission of that organization. So a lot of these bodies are more community focused. So it's just about bringing, you know, the diaspora together, essentially. But some are, You know, like there's organizations out there that do very specific things, like, you know, Chinese people who want to improve cancer screening. Just, I made that up, but like it's that nuance. So the advice that I would give is to actually understand your local ecosystem. So most of these organizations work in state and territories, but underneath that, there's also the council level. So inevitably, whenever I've talked to organizations and everyone really starting anything new, is the question always is about funding, right? How do I get funding to do X? And you need to understand.
It's like a wish list.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's going to pay for my wish list?
And this is the thing that I think most people, I hope they realize, but probably don't say often enough, is that there is not an unlimited amount of money out there. So you've actually got to get good at telling your story, right? I often think about what I would say if I was with Minister Butler in an elevator for 30 seconds, right? Well, what would be the key points? And you make them impactful so that it resonates, and then it actually owns a piece of that person's mind. And that is one of the things. So I mentioned we do community capacity building. We're just about to start a capacity building program, essentially. So we've got about 40 organizations who've signed up to that.
It's quite a lot, actually.
It's a significant amount. And so we're giving them webinars and tutorials as to how to do these things. So policy 101, how the federal budget works, social media, media literacy.
Amazing, yeah.
And how to tell a story. You know,
that's amazing.
So that's the most important thing I think I would try to get people to focus on.
And is there a horizontal... Do you think any horizontal collaboration across the board? Because when we say multicultural, people often think it's a silo. Mm-hmm. However, there would certainly be issues like cancer screening or similar sort of national issues affecting every community. Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of horizontal collaboration?
But there's probably not. I would say there's a coordinator. So like us, right? We're the ones kind of linking all these groups together. But in terms of like cross-cultural collaboration, I haven't seen many. Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Are we too focused for like on our own communities and too many issues within each other?
Well, that's the thing. We haven't even solved those yet. So why would I, you know, try to understand the issues of another organization, you know? And that's one of the things that's difficult about our job, is that we have all these competing interests, obviously, you know. But if we can all focus on the outcome that we want, which is better health for all Australians, then maybe we can find some common ground and work towards something there. But no, I don't foresee that changing anytime in the near future.
I mean, both of us have had time in Canberra, and you know, every February there was this amazing multicultural festival supported by embassies, and you know, the best food. I know the Serbian White Eagles Club? It was like a flagship event. The most money that would come that year.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a moneymaker.
It's a moneymaker, but it used to bring, and it hopefully still does, everybody together, even embassies who would not really open their doors normally, including, let's say, Saudi Arabian embassy or whatever embassy would not normally have, you know, display of beautiful sort of outfits and food.
Yeah.
They would have a huge, I remember, golden stand on one part of the festival. Is there much that government does in that space, kind of bringing multicultural communities together, or is it more formal sort of policy level?
Yeah, so the federal government operates at the federal level. So, you know, and that's who we engage with predominantly. But at the state level, yeah, you do have your offices of multicultural affairs or respective counterparts in each state and territory, and they do things like that, festivals and different things. But you'd have to go almost like state level, geography, local council level, because everyone does their own little thing as well. The ACT actually does that really well.
It's a smaller, maybe, space for that reason, yeah.
It is. So the population size with the small geography probably helps that. But when you think about, like, you know, places like, say, Alice Springs, where I was just at, right, there's Alice Springs, and then there's, like, 1,000 kilometres either side of that make up that region. Like, how are you going to bring all those people together?
One thing I've noticed in Darwin, for example, is the lack of spaces where even local Aboriginal communities would gather. Public spaces, publicly created spaces. For example, if you go to the Pacific Islands, there's so many fafalas where people would get, like, gathering places of conversation, gathering places which are publicly available that anyone can use. I found, for example, in Darwin, there are a couple of local parks, but they're not specific places for gathering where people would converse. Or I don't know how what Alice Springs is like, but I found that it's lacking, that those places of gathering where families could, like, just without cafes, just sort of public spaces.
It's not commercialized.
Not commercialized. And for example, in Serbia, maybe because of the post-communist or communist legacy, there's so many, for example, public chess places where people go every day and play chess, like tables with inbuilt sort of chess boards, for example. Or, like, we don't have even on the northern beaches of Sydney, like, there is, like, one table tennis public one, for example, that you can use.
That's true. I remember growing up in the Philippines and the amount of time you'd spend in community, you know, basketball courts, for example.
Exactly, absolutely.
Whatever it is. And it was such a, like, stark contrast coming to Australia where everyone just kind of stayed in the house, like... I think
actually for us as parents now.
Well, exactly. You know, and now it's like I don't think I even have known the names of my neighbors either side for the longest time now. You know, and it's like, and I don't know if that's a product of
too much space, perhaps.
Maybe too much space. It's also just. You know, like, there are RSLs, right? You know, for...
Would you still have to pay to either be a member or...
Yeah, but nothing... Yeah. Nothing for... There are some multicultural hubs in different states and territories, but it's not a nationwide thing.
I think the only thing we have in Australia really is churches and church communities, which are open, so they're openly welcome for free. A lot of families and individuals and playgrounds and...
Yeah, that is an interesting. Like, when's the last time you saw people kind of just outside without being in an actual event or something? Commercial spaces, yeah.
I was in Serbia recently at the annual Diaspora Congress, so 132 countries, participants came. And I remember there was an association of Serbian parents from Switzerland. And their main focus is how to be a parent in a different country and still preserve your cultural background. And they had an association, which I thought, so this association to help each other, parents. It was a really unusual concept for me, but it really made sense how to preserve your Serbian identity in Switzerland while integrating in Swiss society with, you know, German, French, or Italian, but also how to be a good parent. With inverted commas, you know, good, engaged parent in all that. It was a very interesting, for me, encounter to see what they do as an organization, because I'm not a usual type of...
No, it's a first for me.
Serbian of parents.
They're completely relevant.
From Switzerland. It's amazing.
With red hair.
And do you think that we as individuals in Australia spend enough time talking to each other? I mean, you work with organizations which, like you said, compete for funding, and they all have good stories before, you know, they wouldn't come to you, you wouldn't pay notice if they didn't have a good story and results sort of driven background. But what I felt that, for example, at the summit which we both attended, there were that competition you can feel that everyone's sort of assessing each other, looking at, you know, where do I stand, you know, vis-a-vis you, because you're all competing for the same funding. How to make this space more collaborative, not just competitive, even though there is clear competition for funding?
How do we make it more collaborative?
I mean, you do to work in this space.
I work in the club.
What are some of the strategies, for example, that you guys use or you could recommend for others wanting to be more collaborative?
We... probably to our detriment, try to talk to everybody and give everyone time and space. And so we collaborate probably too much, I would say. It takes time. But how do you make people more collaborative? What we do is we just look for opportunities that other organizations may find of benefit, find some value in as well. And then we just approach them. Like one of my favorite things to do is just sit in a cafe and start a random, like a conversation with a random stranger, right?
And looking at their reactions.
Yeah, and looking at their reactions, you know, but just kind of like that cold calling approach, and just putting yourself out there and seeing where it shakes out. But we kind of have the luxury of time and a mandate because that's what we're meant to do at the Health Collaborative. But for a lot of these organizations, they have very kind of a narrow focus, right? They have a mission, and then anything that deviates outside of that mission or potentially could cause that mission to go a little bit haywire, including competing funding, you know, I myself probably would engage if that were the case. Because ultimately, like, I would hope that a lot of people who work in the not-for-profit space are doing it for admirable, honorable reasons. And whatever your issue is, to you, that should be one of the most important things that you kind of carry with you, right? So if that's true, then why would I want to advocate for your important thing? You know, you kind of have to focus on mine.
So it's a liberal democracy type of
a little bit. And, you know, when you boil it down at the organizational level, like, these are causes, sure, but these are also, you know, the livelihood of people. These are people's jobs. This is what's putting food on
the table. It's not just a hobby.
It's not just a hobby, right? And so, like, you know, I've got two kids, and if anything were to get in the way of me being able to provide for them, right, I would not be a very happy person. And so I guess if there was an unlimited pool of funding, then we could probably get somewhere. But at the moment, it's too fierce, not enough resources.
In the Balkans, the word not-for-profit has a very different connotation than in Australia.
Okay.
It's usually associated with Western influence, inverted commas, the country. So it's a very unusual classification, I would say, because traditionally communist societies had forced organized groups.
Yeah.
And if you look at the data, a lot of that data says that once these people are not communist anymore, they don't want to join.
Interesting.
They don't want to join any organization.
They see it like it's a form of, like, you know, neo-colonialism or something.
Some do. Obviously, there are so many passion projects.
Yeah.
But because it does provide employment, there is a lot of influence in terms of through money and funding from overseas with missions. Like you said, this is your funding, this is your mission. So rather than being locally driven, it's sort of perhaps more top-down with grassroots engagement. Mm. You know, this is your project, produce a report. So for those who are listening to us and don't have Western experience of living in a democratic country where people really do have passion projects that they want to pursue, including in the health space, in aged care, what advice would you give to them in terms of reversing that narrative and explaining, you know, the non-for-profit sector, their importance for the federal government? Like, why is non-for-profit sector important for the Australian federal government in this space?
So why is the not-for-profit sector important for the government?
Yes, because many post-communist societies would not have that experience.
Yeah, so we can call it not-for-profit, but if we were to say it's, we were to rebadge it, right? Let's do like a branding exercise, essentially.
Yes,
right?
I think so.
And then we say, think about it as like the community voice, right? I think that is probably the most effective way I could describe it to governments. The importance of this sector is that it's a community voice. You can't possibly listen to every single person around Australia, but these community organizations, they do have this kind of collective spirit by hanging out with each other that can be translated to government at that federal level. And so
I love that explanation. It's actually really visually appropriate as well. You can imagine what community voice means. Yeah.
And so that's why it's important, because you want to make sure that money is going to the right things, right? And if you don't have an idea you know, I have a commercial background as well, so I kind of tend to think about things commercially, right? But if you were to think about it like you're creating a product, right? You need to understand your market for that product to fit. And that product that the government's creating is, say, health funding, right? Are you just going to like throw a bunch of darts in the air and hope that it hits something? Or are you going to go, all right, this region for this particular population demographic needs this, right? It doesn't have to be multicultural as a population. It can be age. You know, there are some suburbs where obesity is more rampant, right? So targeted services there. I think that's probably what I have to say about that.
Yeah, community voice. Yeah. And data, again, when you mentioned obesity and postcodes, it goes back to the data. And we're having Australia's next census coming up very soon. And unfortunately, there hasn't been much, in my view at least, accent given or emphasis given at the moment, including through multicultural programs in the media and other spaces, about the importance. So why, I guess if I could ask you a very basic question, 101, why is data important in your job?
Why is data important? Data is important because it's the evidence, right? To direct the resources to the right thing, you have to make sure that there is evidence to support it. And the ABS itself is one of the ways in which the government collects this information and understands where the resources need to go. So it is a shame that that hasn't been more widely publicized. You know, I certainly haven't seen much promotion of it this time around. But governments also listen to data, right? But one of the, and just going back to the community voice, there is, quantitative data, obviously, ones and zeros, but there's also this thing that in this sector we call lived experience, right? And there is something that numbers can't tell you, and engaging with communities gives us all this rich data, right? If I give you an example, if we still have time. Okay, so tell me if like ones and zeros can tell you this. So we were engaging on with the cervical cancer cervical screening program, and we were trying to obviously get more people from cold backgrounds to do early cervical screening. And we were getting groups of women together, obviously, but those women actually told us that, oh, you need to get the men here as well. And we were like, okay, why? And they're like, well, you need to convince them of the benefits of early screening, because they won't let us come because they think it's a sexual health thing. And if they're having affairs, that we might be found out through this testing because of STIs, right? That's such an interesting
absolutely different perspective.
Different perspective, right? I'm not sure if a Likert scale in a survey is necessarily going to tell you that.
And it also goes back to the issue of trust. I think a lot of communities who mistrust their own governments that they left because of conflict or war,
yes,
or bad experience with police or whatever it may have been, or even health sector. Coming to Australia and then accepting the role, different type of role of government, can be confronting and almost unbelievable type of thing. Like, is this actually what the government wants?
Exactly, right? So we're about to kick off a program with a private sector partner on vaccination and immunization, right? And if you think of, you put yourself in the shoes of a new migrant, right, who came from a country whose government probably isn't as trustworthy, let's say, as Australia or democratic, right? You come here and the government tells you, hey, you need to inject these things into your kids, right? How likely are you going to be just like on board with that? Like, probably not. So that communication aspect and translating government efforts, health prevention aims to these communities is really, really important. And understand that cultural nuance and understanding is vital to ensure that the government achieves what it wants to do. I know we have some goals. I mean, Minister Butler has some goals, you know, eradicating HIV, you know, by 2030, for example. And there are certain probably multicultural populations that need to be that are critical to ensure that that is successful. You can't just have a, you know, general, hey, let's all get tested for HIV campaign, right? Because it's just not going to resonate.
Not going to work.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned private partnerships. How important are they in terms of the public-private partnerships or even philanthropic efforts, private owners in this space?
Look, it's... As I said, I come from a commercial background, so I'm probably a little bit biased. But as big and bad as the corporate sector is perceived to be, it actually, I think, can be used if done openly and transparently, and to make sure there's little conflict of interest. It can be used to achieve great things. I think with the health expenditure, with the GDP, with the percentage of health expenditure that is taking up the GDP, I think we're going to see less and less funding for health, right? And also aging population, less people working.
More money going to defense, security and cybersecurity.
Right? Exactly. And so you're going to have to utilize these partners at some point. So why not start exploring what they might look like now? And there are some areas which obviously there's very, like, it's not like the collaborative is suddenly going to start wearing, you know, British American Tobacco t-shirts, right? It's probably not a good one. But there are the other ones, like working with some pharma companies, provided that their grants are completely hands-off, right? Always at arm's length, you know? So we have pretty robust governance mechanisms with FECA and the collaborative. And so we make sure that all those partnerships are actually run through our governance committee before we kind of sign on and, you know, start cashing checks.
And how could our listeners who are perhaps from small organizations that would like to find out more about your programs, which website can they visit? Tell us. Give me the promo.
Let me tell you. So one, you can become a member of the collaborative. It's absolutely free of charge.
And then you'll to any community.
Any community, any individual, any researcher, all free. I think we have probably just over 500 members at the moment. But
I don't think anybody knew that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we don't. See, that's the problem when you're doing good work. You don't actually have time to kind of like fly your flag. So I'm going to do my best now. We have over 500 members. It's free membership. Please join, and you get access to all our newsletters, what we're doing, programs, participation opportunities. So sometimes if you're an individual out there and you're listening and you have a particular health issue that you feel passionately about, sometimes you can become consumer representatives on state and federal government committees, and you can actually help influence our health system that way. But the website itself is just multiculturalhealth.org.au. So if you visit that, you should have all the information that you need, and we encourage everyone to just to reach out and tell us what you're experiencing on the ground.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and thank you, Carla, for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Thank you.
Želite da čujete još priča poput ove? Slušajte nas na Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify ili odakle god slušate podcast.